This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, we'll hear from Fiji's first transgender politician to run in elections. Davina Luloma says it was a tough journey to get to where she is.
It was hard for people to accept from this end here. I could remember my voice starts changing and Dad would ask me on this end here, what's happening to your voice?
And 60 years after museum workers cut them from the Tasmanian coastline in Australia, two ancient Aboriginal rock carvings are being returned home.
This is a case where Palawa voices were elevated and people came to the table and they listened and they took decisive action to right a wrong of the past, and if that's what reconciliation is.
Also ahead, we look at an exciting expedition in Papua New Guinea to find a bird that was last sighted more than a century ago. Was it successful? Stay tuned to the show to find out. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. But first, Beijing has said discussing policing with Pacific nations is vital for regional security. It comes after representatives from six Pacific countries met with the Chinese government to discuss security and law enforcement. The virtual meeting comes almost 6 months after China's failed attempt to secure a Pacific-wide agreement, which included policing. Joining us now is ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. Good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning.
Now, Stephen, what's been the reaction to this meeting between Beijing and the Pacific? Has there been concern where you are in Canberra and even amongst Australia's diplomatic allies about it?
Yeah, it's certainly been watched very carefully. I don't think there's necessarily a sense of panic about it, but a broader sense of unease, I think, is probably the best way to put it. Now, that is balanced by the fact that on the face of it, this meeting hasn't been a great success for China. Now, the reasons for that are complicated, but you need to look at the people who actually attended. China's Minister for Public Security attended on their side. Now, that is a very, very senior official. His name is Wang Xiaotong. He is Minister for Public Security, a close ally of Xi Jinping. He's a member of the CCP Central Committee. In other words, he is a serious player in Beijing, a genuinely senior minister. On the Pacific side, there was actually only one Pacific minister to attend what was notionally a, quote, ministerial dialogue, and that was Anthony Veke, Solomon Islands Minister for Police and National Security. But no other Pacific nation actually sent their minister along to this, which is interesting. What's also interesting is despite the fact that Chinese state media said that there were five police chiefs who attended and gave statements from other countries, we've only been able to obtain any evidence of one police chief, Fiji's police chief, actually attending. There's no evidence at this stage that any other police chiefs did. We have still got a few questions in with various countries to confirm this. But it's as few as one police chief actually attended. Others sent their deputies. In the case of PNG, they sent, frankly, a mid-ranking officer along to a meeting with a very, very senior Chinese politician. The other thing that's interesting is that there were no, at least as far as I can tell, solid outcomes out of this meeting. There was no outcomes document, or at least none that I've seen. No one in the Pacific that I've spoken to seems to be working on anything particularly tangible out of this meeting. So, yes, it's being watched quite carefully in Canberra, but the initial assessment of people who watch these things quite closely is that this meeting wasn't a huge success for China.
Yes, very interesting to hear there, the possible intentions of Beijing and what resulted. I mean, let's hear more about that. This is how China has seen the discussions. It's China's foreign ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, speaking at a Ministry of Foreign Affairs briefing.
Representatives of the participating island countries expressed their hope to deepen police and law enforcement cooperation with China to promote security, development and prosperity in the region. As a responsible major country, China has always been there for Pacific Island countries and are a good partner they can trust.
What do you make of that response, Stephen? We're hearing China saying that Pacific countries are looking to them to promote security. Have we heard any of that at all?
Well, there's no doubt that some nations are. Solomon Islands is obviously the most clear example. We've seen over the last year, it's been very rapid, an enormous expansion of the cooperation between China and Solomon Islands in the policing space. We've seen a Chinese team of trainers sent to Honiara just after the riots of a year ago. We've seen that police training team then train a number of police across a number of provinces. We've seen China gift first riot equipment and then some 30 or 50 vehicles, both motorcycles and cars, as well as two anti-riot trucks with water cannons mounted on them. We've seen a large contingent, or a fairly large contingent, of Solomon Islands police going over to China for training, which is happening as we speak. So at least one Pacific Island country is very intent on building these police links with China. Again, much to Australia's enormous unease. But there's not really much evidence, at least at this stage, that there's an appetite for huge police cooperation with other countries. China is building facilities and providing facilities to police in Samoa. But Samoa, for whatever reason, interestingly, wasn't invited to the meeting that they held yesterday. And other countries, including PNG, seem to be making it pretty clear that they are a bit uneasy about the prospect of China coming in with major police cooperation offers, and don't seem to be taking it up in any substantive way. Other countries, like Kiribati, seem open to the idea, but I'm not aware of anything firm happening in that space. But it may well in the future. I guess what's being signalled here by China is that it does want to become, as academics have pointed out, a security stakeholder in the region. It does want to entrench links between its police force and potentially the way its methods of policing and policing in the Pacific. And obviously that's something that Australia and New Zealand want to push back against, because, as they continue to say, they don't believe that there's really a place for China as a security provider or security guarantor in the region, or even really as a police, as a major source of police cooperation. They believe in a, quote, Pacific first approach to security. And their argument is that if there are any security problems in the region, then it's up to the Pacific and countries like Australia to actually provide that solution, not outside players like China. One more interesting thing, Priyanka, if it's okay, I just might point to out of that statement. It wasn't included in the grab that you played just then, but after that grab, Zhao Zhen went on to say that China was open to cooperation with other third parties and developed countries in the region, which is a very clear reference to Australia and New Zealand when it comes to policing and police cooperation. That's interesting to hear the Chinese say that. I don't remember them saying that so clearly before. It seemed to be an offer to Australia to see if they could work together with China to...
Would that ever happen, Stephen? Do we know?
It's a great question. I mean, Australia doesn't want that to happen. Australia sees no utility in it. They believe that there's simply the gap between China and Australia's strategic aims, and the gap in methodology between Chinese policing methods and Australian/Pacific policing methods is so great that it can't be bridged. But it's still interesting that China seems to be at least making, you know, a bit of an attempt to offer a verbal olive branch to Australia.
Interesting. I mean, let's talk about those policing methods, because I know every time we talk about, you know, China's increased, particularly policing engagement with the Pacific, there have been concerns, particularly human rights concerns, around China's policing. We have heard stories about the targeting of dissidents in China and also the surveillance and harassment of ethnic minorities. Is this part of that broader concern coming from Australia and its allies when it comes to the deepening of security relations in the Pacific with Beijing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really at the core of it. And Australia has to be said this publicly as well. It's not something that's sort of whispered just behind closed doors. You might remember Andrew Shearer, this was a while ago, one of Australia's intelligence chiefs. He was at a conference, I think it was earlier this year, and he was asked about Chinese police cooperation with Solomon Islands. And he said very bluntly, we don't want to see the sort of tactics that were deployed so brutally by Chinese police in Hong Kong to be taken into Solomon Islands. It would clash with the Pacific policing culture, and could, paraphrasing him here, but basically implied that it could provoke more tension and confrontation rather than less. So Australia's views are very clearly on the public record there. That's the reason they're anxious about the Chinese coming into the Pacific in a big way. Of course, there's also an underlying anxiety that a police presence could be a precursor to a military presence. But that's a debate for another day.
Yes, indeed. I mean, speaking of Australia's response, it's funny, this tit-for-tat that we're seeing when it comes to China's engagement when it comes to security in Solomon Islands, and then Australia sort of responds. We saw that very recently when we saw Australia respond to provide guns. China followed up with vehicles and water cannons. Is this meeting the next step to this competition? And in fact, can we see Australia perhaps respond in kind?
Yeah, look, Australia's already got a lot of mechanisms for sort of discussion with police chiefs in the region. It tends to go through existing multilateral mechanisms rather than sort of holding, standalone Australia-Pacific police cooperation sort of headline meetings. But there's no shortage of meetings for Australia there are no shortage of mechanisms for Australia to continue that discussion with police chiefs across the region. And often we use defence in this way, which is interesting. So not only will Australian police and AFP have discussions with police ministers, but also defence leaders, particularly because, of course, a lot of Pacific Island nations don't have standing armies or defence forces. So their counterparts are effectively the police. They also have that sort of track through the defence dialogue space as well. So there's no shortage of ways for Australia to hold this discussion with Pacific Island police. Will we see more bidding wars in other countries? Well, look, it's possible. And that's one of the anxieties that I think we've seen in Solomon Islands, which is a uniquely, uniquely sort of poignant place for Australian police, because we've seen obviously a large number of police deployed in the wake of the troubles. We've seen at least one Australian officer lose his life in Solomon Islands. But one of the reasons that Australia has been so keen to stay in the game, for lack of a better phrase, in Solomon Islands is because we desperately don't want to lose the purchase that we've gained there over the years. Now, the worry is that if people look at Solomon Islands and look at all of the loot, for lack of a better word, they've managed to extract from the Chinese in particular, that they may be tempted to do something similar to see if they can play both Australia and China off one another in hope of extracting greater donations from both countries. That would potentially put Australia in a difficult position because Australia doesn't want to be caught up in a bidding war with China. It insists that everything it's done in Solomon Islands it would have done anyway, but it is hard to shake the impression that it's moving at least with more urgency because of the presence of Chinese police and the presence of that competition. That is a dynamic that really does hold a lot of risks for Australia, but more importantly, it holds some risks for the region as well.
Yes, indeed. Well, Stephen, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll have you back to talk about geopolitics in the region, considering how things are going very soon. But thank you for your time this morning.
No problem. Thanks, Priyanka.
That was ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, speaking to us about that very interesting virtual meeting that happened. It was called a ministerial meeting. Only one Pacific minister turned up, but it was to do with security and law enforcement around the region. Pacific Beat. 6 decades after two pieces of ancient Aboriginal rock art were sawn off and acquired by Tasmania's oldest museums, they're on their way home. Formal ceremonies have taken place in the Australian state to hand the art back to the Aboriginal community. And this weekend, they'll be returned to their rightful place. As Alexandra Humphreys reports, it's been labelled an act of reconciliation.
After decades of campaigning, two sacred 14,000-year-old petroglyphs are formally handed back. University of Tasmania Indigenous Fellow and former Senior Curator of First Peoples Art and Culture at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery, Zoe Rimmer, watched on at a smoking ceremony in Hobart.
Today is a huge day. It's a really historic moment. The Pākehā community have been campaigning to have our cultural material and the Lua Makuna, the petroglyphs, returned to be able to put them back in country where they belong.
Nearly 20 years ago, Ms. Rimmer began work at the museum. Back then, one of the Premangana petroglyphs was still on display.
It was sad and really kind of quite underwhelming, sitting behind the glass.
It was moved into storage in 2005. Now it'll be transported back to the rugged stretch of coastline in Tasmania's far northwest, where it was taken from in the early 1960s. The museum formally apologised last year. Since then, the Tasmanian government has signed off on a final permit to get the rock art back home, where it will soon be covered in sand.
To have something, an event like today, and then what's the ceremony that will happen over the weekend, it really brings the community together and, I guess, provides some healing.
In Launceston, a petroglyph held at the Queen Victoria Museum and Art Gallery has also been handed back. Tasmanian Aboriginal leader Michael Mansell says the art was brutally ripped away by museum workers 6 decades ago.
Well, this spiritually, this is absolutely exciting. It's the most exciting thing that's happened to Aboriginal people for 20 years. And it's come about as a result of changes of leadership at the museum in Hobart and in Launceston, and the Tasmanian government getting behind Aboriginal people so that we could make sure this came about.
The hefty slabs of sandstone are worn, covered in circular markings and indentations. Mr. Mansell says the art is part of a larger story that tells Aboriginal people about ancient environments and activities.
The reason it's so significant is because the stories that our ancestors carved 15,000 years ago were being left in the rocks on the west coast for us to read and understand. They don't make sense sitting in a white museum in Launceston or Hobart because they're out of context. And so by taking them back to their place of origin, we can see how they fit into the jigsaw.
This weekend, the art will be placed back where it was taken from. Then Mr. Mansell hopes the public will come to learn the meanings behind the carvings.
Sometimes things are worthwhile waiting for if in the end you get what is deserving. Yes, it has been a long process. It shouldn't have been. But the fact that it's finally happening after 60 years means that there is good in this world somewhere.
They're large, sacred and fragile. Rebecca Digney from the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania says it's been logistically difficult to work out how to move them across Tasmania.
But this is just the start of their journey home. So that they'll travel across Milutina today, across the country, and they'll arrive in Premangana, and there the community will welcome them home. We will have a closed ceremony and then they'll go back into their place.
The petroglyph return is part of a broader reckoning in Tasmania over its treatment of Aboriginal people. As the state looks towards treaty and truth-telling, Ms. Digney says the petroglyph return is an example of working to right past wrongs.
The return of the Lua Makuna to the Palawa community is really an example of reconciliation in action. This is a case where Palawa voices were elevated and people came to the table and they listened and they took decisive action to right a wrong of the past, and if that's what reconciliation is.
That was Rebecca Digney from the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania, ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
Alex Johnston, New Brown and myself, we were all in the same year at school.
Pretty talented class. What graduating year was that?
2012. Right. How old were you then, 45?
Whoa, whoa, whoa. That stings.
46, I'm kidding. You're my bestest friend in the whole wide world.
Can You Be More Pacific? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now it's that time in Pacific at Beat where we find out what's making headlines around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Carl Evans. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Veronica. How are you going?
Yes, very well. Now, this interesting story here around Bougainville independence. There has been speculation that Papua New Guinea might backflip on the idea. Why is that?
Yeah, it doesn't bode too well. So that's according to an Australian academic. His name's Anthony Regan from the Australian National University, who spoke to RNZ. So he spent years working alongside the Bougainville government and says that since the election, PM James Marape had actually appointed a young lawyer, so a new minister for Bougainville affairs in the country, and he worries that by distancing himself from that role, PNG might be getting ready to say no.
Well, very interesting. It is a very touchy subject, I guess. And obviously this comes after that referendum on independence in Bougainville, which was overwhelmingly voted for yes, for independence. And now it's that sort of stage to get to independence. But we have invited members of Papua New Guinea's government on the show to talk about that. And it hasn't been very clear. So now some speculation that there might be a backflip. What else did this expert say?
Yeah, well, just on that referendum, so it's quite interesting. So one of the things Anthony also said about the matter was he referenced James Marape's recent calls to give the PNG people a say on the matter, which in itself he found quite concerning, just because given that, you know, if that verdict comes back as a no, all of a sudden he's got a reason to, you know, back out of talks. So, yeah, it would essentially almost render that referendum, you know, irrelevant in some ways.
Yes, very interesting stuff there. Obviously, this is just speculation from this Australian academic. The government itself hasn't come out, as far as we know, to say anything of this sort. So, but then again, as I said, we did invite the government minister on our show, and we didn't have a very clear idea of what the process was from here to get independence. So, yeah, very interesting. We'll keep an eye and perhaps invite the minister on again to see what they say to these accusations. Now, let's stay in Papua New Guinea because there's been and some other concerns. Now, this is on passport wait times. It's been hitting pretty much around the world since COVID, I feel. We've all been waiting very long for passports, it seems. But this time, it's for an unlikely reason, not to do with COVID-19 and everyone rushing to go overseas. What is that reason?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, it might actually be a common reason, but I think they've just been a lot more specific on the matter. But there's actually a severe shortage of passports. Passport books, according to the country's Immigration and Citizenship Authority. So, yeah, those are some cool little shiny books that you get for the first time. It's really exciting. Yeah. So this is reported by the Post Courier, and apparently people have been waiting up to 6 months for their passports, only to be told it's yet to be printed.
Oh, gosh, 6 months. That can be stressful if you're waiting for a holiday or work or something important to take you overseas. Yeah, passports are funny because you can't really recycle them. There's no way to, like, use it again. If the cutoff date happens, then you just have to go for a new one. So you can understand that there might be a shortage in the books. But why? Has the government actually said why there is this shortage?
Yeah, well, not surprisingly, the delays follow, you know, unprecedented demand for passports. Obviously, we've all just gone through a two-year pandemic where none of us travelled and all of a sudden, you know, passports expired and we all needed new ones at the same time.
I've been there.
So, yeah, due to those delays, that's happened. It's also got a bit of a triage format as well in place, which means that certain passports are prioritised. So people such as students or people who might require emergency treatment abroad, their passports tend to get pushed to the front of the line. But I suppose it raises a question, not just in PNG, but globally. You know, is it time for passports to finally go digital?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a good question. With all these hacking reports in the Pacific and here in Australia, I'm not so sure. I wouldn't feel safe having all my information there. But I assume it exists in some database, all that information somewhere out there.
You'd have to think we wouldn't be too far off. It's sometime in the next 10 years, I'd imagine they'd have to, you know.
It'll probably be just some scan. They'll inject us with something, tattoo us when we're when we're babies, fresh out of the womb, and then suddenly we can travel everywhere, but we just need to be scanned.
Careful, Prank. You might scare people.
That hasn't happened yet. Don't worry, everyone. And maybe it's good. Who knows? I don't have tattooing babies. Anyway, and now to some sporting news. The Fijiana Ndrua will finally get to play in front of home fans for the first time in 2023. Is that right? As in they haven't ever played before?
No, it's been bubble life for the Drua since entering the competition, unfortunately due to COVID, but they'll finally get to play in front of home fans from next season. So the Super W 2023 Drua has been released. And they won't have to wait long to get back in front of their home fans either. So they'll be playing at home in round one against the ACT Brumbies, which will be on March 25 at Prince Charles Park in Nandi. And they'll be back the following week in Suva to play the Melbourne Rebels.
Wow, that's exciting. And so the Super W, I'm a bit clueless when it comes to sports, as you know, Carl. I didn't realise the Super W is going to be played in Fiji, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Next year.
It is. So like I said, they're only a new competition, you know, similar to the men, but unlike the men, the Drua have made a huge impact since entering the competition. They won the premiership last year, sensationally upsetting the New South Wales Waratahs back in April in that thrilling come-from-behind win. I mean, it's tragic in some ways that the home fans haven't been able to enjoy them, but they're finally going to be able to.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, we got the privilege of seeing that here in Melbourne, I believe, and I caught up with some of the Fijianas as well when they were here. So it is exciting. And yes, 2023 continues the exciting time in rugby, as we keep on saying here on Pacific Beat.
I'll be facing my home team, the ACT Brumbies, in round one. Hopefully they go easy on them.
Oh, really? Is that your home team? Okay. Well, who will you be barracking for then?
I'll definitely be going for the Drua. 100%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I haven't been a big fan of the Brumbies since they changed the name to the Brumbies. They're no longer considered the ACT Brumbies anymore.
Oh, but, it's just the Brumbies.
But ask anyone from Canberra, they're still the ACT Brumbies. Yeah.
Well, we'll all be supporting Fijiana. Well, thank you, Kyle, for those stories from around the region.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest. But don't go anywhere, because do we have an exciting story for you? This is about a bird, to be exact, a black-naped pheasant pigeon, I hope I said that right, from Papua New Guinea that hasn't been seen for almost a century and a half. But I think there's been an update, because we'll be speaking to a co-leader of an expedition, that headed to Papua New Guinea to try and track down the pigeon. I believe it was successful. I wouldn't imagine why we would have them on the show otherwise, but we'll find out, because I think there's a caveat there. So stay tuned for that. And also coming up on the show, we'll be speaking to or hearing from Fiji's first transgender political candidate. That's Divina Luluma. She's running in this year's, or well, very soon, the December election that's coming up. We'll hear about her journey and some of the obstacles she's faced to becoming a politician there. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Hope you're having a lovely Thursday morning. Now for a story out of Papua New Guinea. A rare bird thought to be extinct has been sighted for the first time in more than, and hear this, 140 years. The black-naped pheasant pigeon was spotted on camera by an expedition team while searching the island of Ferguson, and that island is east of the PNG mainland. The island was the last documented location of the bird, which hadn't been seen since 1882. John Mittermeier is the director of the Lost Birds Program at the American Bird Conservancy. I can't pronounce that. John, you'll have to tell me. But you were also the co-leader of the expedition and is with us now from Zimbabwe. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Priyanka. And yes, you're very close. There was American Bird Conservancy.
Conservancy. Okay. Well, I mean, being part of the American Bird Conservancy, I'm sure you were very excited to locate this bird. Did you get to see it yourself? Was it just on camera? What was it like seeing this bird?
So I never saw it myself. Actually, none of our team got to see this bird in person. We only got it on the camera. And I think that, you know, it says a little bit about the bird itself. It's extremely elusive. It seems to be extremely shy. So we were extremely happy to document it, to get the pictures. But I also would have loved to see it myself. Might have to save that for the next trip, though.
And did you go to this island? Did you go to Papua New Guinea particularly to find this bird?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we planned this entire expedition in search of this one particular bird. It was a species that had appeared on our radar as part of our larger Search for Lost Birds program, which has identified around 140 species of birds around the world that are lost, meaning that they have no confirmed documentation in the form of photos, audio recordings, or genetic material in the last 10 or more years. And among that list, the pheasant pigeon is one of only about 20 birds that had not been documented for more than a century. And it was also critically endangered. So we thought it was a real priority species to look for.
And so is the reason why it hasn't been seen for so long, I mean, almost a century and a half, because it was shy, or is it just really small, hard to locate, or are the numbers really low?
So that's a good question. And I think probably a combination of some of those things. It's very, very shy, very elusive. But I think also to be clear, it hadn't been documented by scientists for more than a century. But in fact, as we discovered over the course of this expedition, and how we did eventually find the bird, was by tapping into the knowledge of the local people there on Ferguson Island. And it turns out they'd been seeing the pheasant pigeon much, much more recently. And it was by talking to them and eventually finding one man in particular who had seen it just a few months earlier and was able to take us to the exact spot where he had seen that bird. And that's where he set our camera. That's where he got the picture. But it was really a process of talking to the local people and getting to learn about their knowledge of this bird. And they had seen it much more regularly than much more recently, sorry, than any scientific reports had.
Oh, wow. So was there a bit of you that thought, oh, maybe you won't find it? Maybe the whole expedition might be for nothing?
Yes. Yes, there was. There were many moments of worry there. Actually, when we first arrived on the island, we started interviewing people in a few communities there. And the first few people we talked to were incredibly knowledgeable about birds. They knew many of the local species. They knew them by call. They knew them by sight. And when we asked them about this bird, they said quite confidently that they'd never seen it and they'd never heard about it. And so once we started to get information like that, we thought, wow, maybe this bird is not in this area. Maybe it's been extinct for quite a while. And we were on Ferguson for four weeks, almost a month. And it was literally on the second to last day that we did finally get this picture. And not long before we saw the picture, I was actually doing interviews with some of my colleagues where we were talking about how we felt, our sort of feelings about having not found the bird. So we really thought we were going to fail. There were many moments where we thought we were not going to be able to find this species. And then at the very last moment, things took a turn for the better.
Yeah. I mean, what was that day like? Did you just have one camera and putting all your hopes on this one camera? Did you have anything there to entice the bird to come check it out?
We didn't have anything to entice the bird, but what we did is we'd place the camera in a spot where this local man, Augustine Gregory, had recommended that we put it. It was a spot where he said he'd seen the bird before. So we were following his advice. It turned out to be excellent advice. And that's how we selected the location. But nevertheless, despite having this advice, there was still a lot of uncertainty, you know, in talking with him, because there had been so few records of the bird. We weren't even sure at times if we were talking about the same type of bird or if maybe he was thinking of a different species than we were. So there was a ton of uncertainty. We actually had quite a lot of cameras out. We had 20 cameras with us in total. And the vast majority of the cameras got nothing. So it was really just, you know, that first photograph was one camera. It happened to be the only animal we actually got We photographed on that camera. So we really felt just unbelievably lucky when we first saw those pictures.
Yeah, I mean, talk us through that that moment of seeing it. So it was a camera. I imagine it went off when the bird approached. How did you feel looking back at the footage and seeing that you had this long-lost bird on tape?
Yeah, it was a full range of emotions. I mean, I think just disbelief, excitement, happiness. There's a little video clip going around that of one of our team members, Doka Nason, his response when he actually first saw the picture there, and you know, just the pure joy that he has there, I think really captures it. Another big feeling for me was just a sense of relief. You know, there was a lot of we were working really hard. There was a lot of concern that we might not find this bird from a conservation perspective. You know, despite getting some of these reports, we were also hearing, you know, reports of people seeing the bird. We were also hearing from many people that they didn't know about the bird, as I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, from the conservation perspective, I was starting to really get concerned that this species might be extinct, or we might be too late to find it. So just a huge sense of relief that the bird was still there and that we'd been successful in our search for it.
And just finally, John, what happens now? You have this footage, you know the bird exists. What's the plans now?
Yeah, so we have the footage, we know the bird exists. But to be honest, that's about all we know right now. There's still a ton we need to learn about this bird. And I think the first step is just to find out a little bit more about where exactly it occurs on Ferguson Island, what the population size might be, what threats it might be facing, and how we might be able to work with local communities there to try and protect it and ensure that it doesn't become lost again.
Yes, hopefully it's not another 140 years before scientists find it again. John, thank you so much for staying up late in Zimbabwe to chat to us about this exciting discovery.
Absolutely. Thank you, Priyanka.
That was John Mittermeier, the director of the Lost Birds Program at the American Bird Conservancy, and he's the co-leader of that amazing expedition to find that black-naped pheasant pigeon for the first time by scientists since 1882. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on Radio Australia, ABC Radio Australia to be precise. Hope you're having a lovely Thursday morning. Almost 3 decades ago, Divina Loloma left her home in Fiji to study in Australia. And it was there, in Sydney, that she found the courage to support to transition from her gender assigned at birth to a woman. And now she is the first transgender person to contest an election in Fiji. She's running for a seat with the National Federation Party. Marion Farr spoke to Ms. Loloma about what her journey was like. She said it was difficult, but one that she is deeply passionate about.
When I got into high school, I started being attracted to males. I thought to myself that this attraction is not normal, you know, and for me, inside of me, I could feel that I don't see myself as gay, but I see myself different. And the different was something that when I stepped into Australia, that is basically what I saw, my dream. I think it's basically who I really wanted to be.
Tell me about why you decided to come to Australia.
I think it was exposure that sort of like led me to Australia. And coming to Australia in 1987 was something that was eye-opening for me.
Did it feel unsafe to transition in Fiji?
Yes, it's very unsafe to transition in Fiji simply because at that time in the 80s, during that time it was very fearful. You know, there were a lot of violence happening.
Tell me a little bit about your experience of coming to Australia. You mentioned that it was eye-opening. Like, what was eye-opening and what helped you, I guess, kind of find yourself?
Meeting my first transgender friends was, you know, it was my dream come true. And just looking at them transit and looking at them, looking after their health, looking after their mental capacities, reassuring themselves that they are able to live more peacefully. Mm-hmm. For me, that was actually really telling me that I can have a way forward about myself, how I would live my life as a transgender woman.
So when your family started noticing, you know, your voice changing when you were talking to them over the phone, at that point, had you told them that you were transitioning?
No, I haven't. I haven't told them. I'd only told them about the transitioning process when I was leaving Australia to come back to Fiji.
Why did you decide to go back to Fiji and what was that like?
My dad was getting a bit sick. I just felt to myself that now I could actually go back and look after him. Respectfully, I said to them that this is basically who I am and there's nothing that's going to change. And if you disagree, I will continue to serve my people. I will continue to serve my people any way or the other. Representation is powerful in itself.
What gave you the strength to kind of go through those hard moments?
I believe that it is God. I continue to believe that God actually, you know, is my security and my safety.
Davina, what's inspired you or motivated you to get into politics and to run in this election in Fiji?
I believe that everyone needs to be empowered to achieve and given the opportunity to be part of the development processes, regardless of who they are. I continue to believe that the suffering of the nation from this governing system in the last 15 years, I feel that a lot of people have suffered and here we are. I tend to represent the most vulnerable.
You've joined the National Federation Party. They haven't released, the party hasn't released its manifesto yet, but in the 2018 manifesto, it didn't make any mention of LGBTQI rights that I could see. So what priorities do you want to see this party push for?
Interesting thing about it is having me in the party, that's number one. That gives the people of this country that the party in itself is inclusive.
What about, like, in terms of policies? Are there any particular policies that you would like to push for?
I believe that there's so much violence in the country. I think there's more through the dictatorship of this government, this present government. I believe that there has to be violence is not to be tolerated. I believe that hatred speeches, it has to be removed. I would be looking at more empowerment strategies. I would like to be part of the economical development structures in which young people of this nation can be part of. I believe that the richness of this country lies within the young people.
You mentioned that you've been campaigning in 25 villages across Fiji so far. Has campaigning been difficult? Have you experienced much stigma?
Well, like I've said, God is actually my refuge. He's my strength. I do a lot of fasting and praying. This is actually has really built me to come in strong in terms of coming into places where I could feel that there could be some backlash. But surprisingly, coming into these villages, they are very well accepting. You know, they just want to hear what I have to say. And it's, you know, it excites them to hear what I have to say in terms of empowerment, in terms of development, in terms of ensuring there's a way forward.
And that's NFP candidate Davina Luluma speaking there with Marion Farr. And it makes for an interesting election for LGBTQI people in Fiji, including trans woman Ratu Eruni Ledua Dina, who is program manager at the Pacific Sexual and Gender Diversity Network. She's hoping more queer representation will lead to a range of policy changes.
Definitely something that we would like to see being leveraged in Parliament by Davina if she gets the chance to be representing us there in Parliament is for trans-affirming policies. When I say trans-affirming policies, I'm alluding to the basic needs of trans people with regards to their trans-specific health services, the need in that area. And of course, with regards to safety and security, we're referring to how there needs to be mechanisms or certain legislations elaborated to include, for example, to support the change of names. Then, of course, you have transforming policies within the health system that would look like the provision of hormonal therapy and counselling. And, of course, trans-specific health services. the opening up of trans-specific clinics because of the rot of stigma and biases that exist in society. Trans people need their own spaces that protects them and, of course, make sure that they continuously have access to these very important services. Trans people are known to not access health services, and most are at risk of NCDs and, of course, STI-related problems because of their unwillingness to access mainstream health services. So trans-affirming policies would mean opening clinics that look after trans-specific people. For me as a person, this would be my second time having a chance to vote somebody into Parliament within my lifetime. So yes, it's quite significant for me as a person. It's also quite significant for me as a trans person, knowing that I'm going to into the booth and then I'm looking at the candidate list and I can see one of my own people represented there. And of course, knowing that there's quite a few very huge allies from the feminist movement that are also standing in elections. So yes, I do hope that the results, when they do come out, are in the favor of marginalized people, including us. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And of course, quite significant on a more personal note, election day just happens to be on my birthday. So yeah.
That was Pacific Sexual and Gender Diversity Network Program Manager Ratu Aroni Ladua Dina. And with that, it brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thanks for your company this morning.